the full waiver restrictions have been. Before I start, my name is Rowan Akrabaki. I'm a graduate affiliate from the center and I'm a PhD candidate in the Department of Sociology here at York. Before I start and introduce the speakers for today, I just want to read a little bit of acknowledgement. So I want to begin by acknowledging the gratitude to people who lived and worked in this place before us, the Anishinaabe Nation, the Huron Wendat, the Haudenosaunee, Confederacy, the Métis, and the current treaty holders, Mississauga, the Kinnipeh First Nation. We acknowledge that when European settlers first came to this land, they entered into a sacred treaty with the indigenous people here, the Tuwurra Wampum, and agreement to peacefully share and care for the Great Lakes region. We acknowledge that this treaty and many others have been and continue to be violated by European and Canadian colonial practices that exploit and spoil the land, the water, the air, and all beings that live here. We acknowledge that we are all treaty people, that whatever we do to the land and to others, we do to ourselves. We seek new ways of being in relationship with the indigenous peoples, for our hosts, and with this land where we are guests. So today we have Rebecca Tarla, who will be telling us about occupying schools and occupying land of Netflix workers, movement transformed resilient education. There will be copies of the book available today. I'll just briefly introduce Rebecca, and of course, I'll introduce Leo, who doesn't really need an introduction, but I will anyway. And in the meantime, we'll also start passing around a signing sheet, so please do sign it. It's important that we get those signatures so we can tell the administration that the center is active and alive, and people come to our events, and it's a vibrant space. I just want to start by introducing Rebecca. Rebecca Keller is an assistant professor of education and labor and employment relations with Pennsylvania State University, affiliated with the Lifelong Learning and Adult Education Program, the Comparative International Education Program, and the Center for Global Workers' Rights. She's a PhD in education from the University of California, Berkeley, and was a postdoctoral scholar at Stanford University. Her ethnographic research agenda has three broad areas of focus, which will come through today, theories of the state and state-society relations, social movements, critical pedagogy and learning, and Latin American education and development. Rebecca comes from a family of labor organizers. She herself is an activist, and she soon followed. She does solidarity work with U.S.-based Friends with the Landless Workers movement in Brazil. Rebecca will give her a presentation for about 50 minutes. Our discussant for today is Leo Panitch. Leo Panitch is a professor emeritus at the Department of Politics at York. He is one of the founders of the GLRC and an editor of the annual Socialist Register. They're having a launch tonight, by the way. If you haven't heard, so you can go. And that's been around since about 1985. Leo is the author of many books, including the prize-winning The Making of Global Capitalism, The Political Economy of the American Empire with Sam Gindin. Leo's new book, Searching for Socialism, The Project of the Labor New Left from Tony Benn to Jeremy Corbyn, is forthcoming this spring. So please join me in welcoming Rebecca.
Thank you all for coming today. I know there were some competing talks happening, so I appreciate everyone's time and willingness to listen to me share my work and my research and my activism with you all. I want to definitely thank the Center on Labor Research that Ron is heading up. She's been very persistent since last semester that I come to Toronto and give a talk, so she's the reason that she got me here, so thank you. Thanks to Sirlock, Latin American Studies community here, and Roman for introducing me, and Leo for being a discussant. So thank you all. As you all know, I'm going to be giving this talk about my recently published book, Occupying Schools, Occupying Land, How the Landless Workers Movement Transformed Brazilian Education. And so broadly, this book is about social movements and their relationship to education and the state. I got interested in this topic not as an academic, but as an activist myself, embedded in the student movement, the anti-sweatshop movement, and the anti-war movement. And when I was a junior in college, I had the opportunity to go to Brazil for the first time and work with a feminist organization that was in the northeast of Brazil that had the mission mission statement of ending all forms of sexism, racism, and capitalist exploitation, which I thought was a pretty good book. And so I asked the founder of the organization, Lorgis, how they plan to do that. And she pointed to a picture of a person. Can anyone guess who she pointed to? Any guesses? One person. Paulo Freire, thank you. So she pointed to the picture of Brazilian educator Paulo Freire because the women in the organization were using the ideas that Freire developed in his famous book, Pedagogy of the Oppressed, in order to raise the political consciousness of people in the community and engage them in action. And so I watched as this organization would, for example, gather together elder women and have them read the UN Declaration of Human Rights, and then talk about whether or not they actually have those rights in their community, and if not, what to do about it. So at a very, very young age, I got obsessed with this idea of education as a pedagogy of social change. And I was really curious why at least our movements in the United States didn't have these same types of grassroots educational initiatives. And so I decided to go back to, go to graduate school because I wanted to continue to study social movement-led educational initiatives. However, when I got through my PhD program in social and cultural studies and education at UC Berkeley, instead of learning about educational alternatives, all we did was read theory after theory after theory about why the public education system is oppressive and simply reproduces the same social, economic, and racial inequities in society. And so I began to wonder, is it possible for the public school system to embody the radical educational pedagogies that I had observed in Northeast Brazil? And so I shifted the focus of my dissertation, which became this book, to this question of how Brazilian social movements have attempted to transform public education over the past four decades. And so, broadly, the driving questions of the book are how can a new social movement work with and through and outside of the state to promote their broader social and economic goals, and what is the role of public education in processes of social reproduction and resistance? The biggest lesson that I learned from this research and the take-home point for all of you today is that transforming schools is just one very small component of a much broader social strategy that Brazilian social movements have embraced over the past 3.5 decades. These social movements aren't simply moments of protest, as many of our movements are in the US, but rather they're complex organizational bodies and collectivities embedded in national and international networks. And really importantly, these social movements don't just contest the state, but rather they engage in what German student activist Rudi Dutschke, drawing on Italian Marxist Antonio Gramsci, referred to as the long march through the institutions. Social movement leaders engage in the long march when they enter the state, helping to carry out the daily job of public service provision while linking those actions to a broader process of social struggle and a long-term strategy for economic and political change. This means contesting power in all state spheres, whether that's the schools, the universities, the healthcare clinics, the transportation offices, the sanitation centers, or local governance. In other words, Brazilian social movements have gained tremendous power over the past 3 decades by working with, in, through, and against the state in order to promote their social and economic values in all spheres of social life. And in this book, I argue that this long march to the institutions has increased the internal capacity of these social movements to exist over several decades and has allowed them to achieve a lot of their social and economic goals. And of course, the social movement that most embodies this long march strategy, represented by my friend's hat over there, is the Brazilian Landless Workers Movement. So who, over there, also, we have MSTs up all over. So who here has heard, just raise your hand if you've heard of the MST before, the Landless Workers Movement. Okay, so almost everyone, but not everyone, so just to give a little bit of background, the MST arose in the MST arose in the late 1970s, early 1980s, And interestingly, the MST did not arise as one united movement, but rather dispersed attempts of landless farmers who were inspired by liberation theology and the Catholic Church, decided to take the issue of poverty into their own hands and occupy unproductive land estates. Even during a period of dictatorship, this action, this strategy of land occupation and squatting actually worked, and the government would redistribute this land to these landless farmers. And so in 1984, after thousands of landless farmers had already gotten land through occupation, the leaders of these occupations came together and they decided to found the Brazilian Landless Workers Movement, or the Movimento Sem Terra, the MST, with its founding slogan, "The land belongs to those who work it." Since the early 1980s, the movement has grown to include 1.5 million women, men, and children, with 350,000 families that now have land access due to this process of occupation. The movement continues to occupy land to this day, and in fact, this is a picture of a land occupation that I participated in during my research in 2011, when right before the occupation, everyone shouted, "Hebeka, Hebeka, jump over the fence and take a picture." And so I was able to jump over the fence and take this incredible picture of a land occupation in process, which just goes to show you why ethnography is so much more fun than any type of social science methodology. Currently, the MST articulates the struggles in terms of land reform, agrarian reform, and social transformation. Although land reform, or access to land, is one aspect of agrarian reform, the MST likes to divide the initial fight for land from the fight to get the resources to live a dignified life on the land, through which you need roads and housing, technical assistance, and of course, schools. The MST's goal for social transformation is its most controversial goal, as it openly critiques capitalism and embraces historical attempts to construct socialism. Over the past three decades, the MST's goal of social transformation has also evolved to include gender equity, racial justice, indigenous rights, and most recently, over the past few years, LGBTQ working class rights. Education is a huge part of achieving all these goals. And although the MST's most famous fight is for agrarian reform, I would argue that its transformation of the rural public school system might end up being its longest lasting legacy. Over the past three decades, the movement has gotten access to more than 2,000 schools with 8,000 teachers and 250,000 students. All of these schools are run by municipal and state governments. And a lot of these local governments actually allow activists to engage in the co-governance of these schools, implementing organizational and curricular practices that teach youth to stay in the countryside, to become farmer intellectuals, to engage in activism, to practice direct democracy and more collective forms of work. In addition, the movement has partnered with over 80 public universities in order to run adult education, high school education, and higher education programs throughout the country. These programs are a type of affirmative action program specifically for land occupation participants, because you can only enter these programs if you or your parents have occupied land. You've gotten land through land occupation, or you're currently squatting on land. Only those people can enter these programs. And hundreds of thousands of people have gone through them over the past 10 years. These programs have transformed the MST from a movement of farmers with at most sixth grade education to a movement of farmers with college education in a variety of disciplines and professions. So these are some huge accomplishments, right? And interestingly, I would argue that these accomplishments really go against a lot of the predictions in the academic literature. Specifically, in the sociology of social movement literature, there's an argument that social movements inevitably become more conservative and less effective as they institutionalize. This enduring perspective goes back to Robert Michel's argument of the iron rule of oligarchy, that organizations get more and more oligarchical over time, and also Piven and Cloward's claim that protest is the most effective form of social movement action. Of course, as me and Leo talked about before this, lots and lots of scholars have taken, including Frances Fox Tiven herself, have taken more nuanced perspectives on this issue of social movement and state engagement. Just to mention a few, Sonia Alvarez talks about the dual strategy of feminist activists working both within and outside of the state. Jonathan Fox talks about a similar sandwich strategy. Patrick Keller has talked about how the Communist Party in India has institutionalized redistributive policies. And a great book, if you haven't read it, it came out 2 years ago, you should go read it. Tiana Pachel does a comparison of black movements in Brazil and Colombia, showing how the black movements in both countries transformed the state with really huge results in terms of affirmative action and land titling policies for black rural people. And in addition, there's an entire body of participatory democracy, Latin Americanists who study participatory democracy, who say over and over again that social movements in Latin America both demand avenues to participate in the state and also autonomy from that very same state. So again, lots of nuanced perspectives. However, I would argue that this question of how social movements should engage the state continues to vex both scholars and especially activists. So the Zapatistas, for example, are embraced for taking the exact opposite strategy of MST and creating counter-institutions outside the realm of the state. The Occupy Wall Street movement was really torn around this question of whether to make demands in the state or to create the perfect social world within the confines of Zuccotti Park in New York City. The Chilean student movement has also really divided on the question of how to relate to electoral politics. And the MST itself is highly critiqued by leftist party leaders in Brazil for the relationship with their worker party. And in fact, many leftists are claiming that the MST has indeed been co-opted, giving up its ability to organize large land occupations for the crumbs of the neoliberal state. And so again, I think that this question of how social movements engage the state continues to be the central dilemma for a 21st century movement. However, this fear about engaging the state does not explain this question. Oh, and this is just, you're not an education crowd, but in the world of education, the idea that schools simply reproduce the same inequality is as strong as ever, right? But these fears about engaging the state do not explain this picture. So in this picture, you're looking at a public school that the MST has gotten legal recognition to be recognized as an illegal encampment. And furthermore, the movement has gotten the ability to have this school move with the movement of the movement. Or in other words, in this case, the movement is marching to the governor to demand more resources, and the school is legally allowed to march with the movement to the Capitol. So in this case, the school continues to be a state institution, but is now part of that same, of the mobilization of a movement against that same state. And I don't know if this looks more like the state co-opting the MST or the MST co-opting the state, right? So back to my book. The big sort of contribution I'm trying to make, the theorization of social movements, is a move away, on the one hand, from an idealization of protest as the only effective form of social movement action, but also a way, on the other hand, of an uncritical embracing of state institutions and negotiation with the state. Instead, I talk about what I call contentious co-governance, which is when social movements engage in the provision of public services with state actors while simultaneously organizing contentious political actions and promoting practices that come into conflict with institutional norms and the interests of the state itself. So in other words, protest is not enough, but neither is negotiation. You need both of them over and over and over again, as I'm going to show in the rest of my talk today. Second argument is that contentious co-governance does not simply get demands met, but rather it's a great way for social movements to increase their internal capacity and their long-term relevance. And third, these types of state collaborations don't just happen under left-wing regimes, but rather they can happen under a variety of contexts, including right-wing and conservative governance. I make all these arguments in the book based on 20 months of ethnographic research. Let me just say, I also have sort of education-specific arguments. One is that I argue that formal schools are strategic terrains for social movements to garner influence. So of all the state institutions, public schools are particularly important because they can help recruit new activists, in particular youth and women to the movement. They can help working class activists obtain state-recognized degrees that enhance their power to negotiate with elite actors. And they also can help us prefigure in the current world the social practices that they hope to build in the future. So those are some education-specific arguments throughout the book. Again, I do this research based on 20 months of ethnographic research in various regions of Brazil. For every single day of this research, I live in the homes of MST educational activists, and I participated in the daily life of the MST's educational struggle, whether that's a teacher training or an activist strategy session or a state activist negotiation or just the daily life of the public schools. I did research with, I did interviews with over 200 people. Half of them were MST activists and teachers, and half of them were actually state officials in order to understand the shifting dynamics between the social movement and the state. This is what I call a multi-sided political ethnography because I'm looking at social movement-state relations in five different public school systems, in two municipal administered systems in the state of Pernambuco, and then in three state administered systems in Rio Grande do Sul, São Paulo, and Ceará, while also looking at these dynamics in two different federal ministries. I look at both cases of success, where the MST is able to transform public schools, and also cases that are much more challenging, where the movement's participation has been marginalized, or where their gains have been reversed, or where the movement has actually never been able to enter the public school system. As you can see, it's a long book, so thank you for reading it. And it's a long book because it follows the trajectory of one social movement over 35 years in five different public school systems and at the federal level, which encompasses hundreds of schools and dozens of educational programs. So to give you a little map of the book, the first part of the book talks about how the MST developed an educational program to support its broader struggle and the trajectory of those programs at the federal level. And the second half of the book looks at these regional cases, the comparison of the five public school systems. This is where I really get into the nitty-gritty of how activists negotiate with state actors in both left-leaning and very conservative contexts. So that's the whole book. Today, for the rest of the talk, I'm just going to focus on one chapter, chapter two, which is about a national educational reform called PRONERA, the National Program for Education in Areas of Agrarian Reform. I focus specifically on this chapter and this program because PRONERA is one of the most important educational gains that the MST has ever had, and it has wide implications for social movements and higher educational institutions globally. But I also focus on this program because it really emphasizes this idea that co-governance is both a constant process of contestation and collaboration. In particular, I'm going to talk about three struggles that surrounded PRONERA. One is massive protests and state openings. The second is finding local allies and keeping them. And the third is defending institutional gains. But before I go into that first struggle, I'm just going to give you a little bit of background of what the MST's educational initiatives looked like in the mid-1990s. Okay, y'all still with me? Great. So by the mid, does anyone know who that is right there in the middle? Maybe the person who said it. That's Paulo Freire right there, at the very end of his life. So by the mid-1990s, the MST already had dozens and dozens of educational initiatives funded by local governments, which included massive literacy programs, childcare programs, and also most impressively, the movement's own high school in the southern state of Rio Grande do Sul, which is a high school that offered both a technical degree in teaching or a technical degree in agricultural cooperative administration. And so if you were an MST activist in the early 1990s and you didn't have a high school degree, you would be quickly shipped off to this school in the southern part of the state to get your high school degree through the MSD's alternative educational approach. And so by 1996, the MSD was able to publish a cohesive document called the MSD's Educational Principles, which discussed both the philosophical and the pedagogical principles of education that the movement embraced, which I'm not going to talk about right now, but I'm happy to talk about in the question and answer session. Nonetheless, despite these humongous educational initiatives, in the mid-1990s, very few MSD activists had a higher education degree. Although these activists were constantly studying in non-formal educational programs, in the eyes of the Brazilian state, they were still just high school graduates. And so I talked to one activist about why it was so important for the movement to get higher educational access. She told me, when you are in the movement, you're an activist 24 hours a day. You are always at the disposal of the movement. It is hard to fit in the routine of formal education because you would have to stop your activism to study. Lots of people were doing this, leaving the movement because we had reached the ceiling to the level of education that activists could attain. The professors at universities would also not respect us. We entered a limit because we did not have higher education. However, we did not want to study in any type of university. We started analyzing how we could offer higher education to our activists. And so it was this challenge that MSD faced in the mid-1990s that brings us to our first struggle, massive protest and state opening. So as you all know, politics students in the mid-1990s globally, and especially in Latin America, governments were implementing neoliberal reforms that were eliminating tariffs, slashing social funding, and opening up local markets to international investment. Fernando Henrique Cardoso, elected in 1995, really represented this fiscal and monetary approach. And so in response to his election, the MSD began to organize massive land occupations across the country. And although Fernando Henrique had said he supported agrarian reform in his campaign, when this started happening, he began to critique the occupations, which emboldened local elites to take action against the movement. On April 17, 1996, in the northern state of Pará, state military police opened fire on an MST march, immediately killing 19 MST activists, what became known as the Massacre of El Dorado dos Cadarjás. The massacre was caught on camera, and this sparked international outrage and, ironically, a surge of support for agrarian reform in Brazil. And so the following February, the MST organized the National March for Agrarian Reform, with thousands and thousands of activists leaving from three corners of the country and marching to the capital city of Brasilia. They arrived at the capital city on April 17, 1997, the one-year anniversary of the massacre, with 100,000 people. Under this pressure, Fernando Henrique had to respond and offer concessions to the movement. By the end of his first term in office, he had redistributed more land to landless farmers than all the previous administrations over the previous decades combined. In addition, the MSD's educational initiatives had a direct result from these national mobilizations. MSD leader Edgar Polling says that education got a free ride in Brazil's known as a carona on the tail of these national mobilizations. On April 17, 1998, the two-year anniversary of the massacre, Fernando Henrique Cardoso decided to sign into law a national program, the National Program for Education in Areas of Agrarian Reform. So in other words, the MSD's most important educational victory did not come from a left-leaning administration, but rather from conflict and bloodshed. Which brings us to our second struggle, which is finding local allies and keeping them. So Pronera was initially intended to be a literacy program, and indeed it funded tons of new literacy and adult education programs throughout the country. However, the MST was not satisfied. They wanted to use Pronera to renew their search for higher educational access. And so they went to dozens of public universities saying, "We have funding. Will you organize an undergraduate degree program in partnership with us for our activists?" all the public universities said no. And Edgar Foley, the MSD educational activist I mentioned, he really interpreted this negatively. He said that although these universities would invite activists to talk about their literacy programs, the idea that Centejas, that landless people, could come to the university to study as peers was intolerable. And so the MSD's search for higher educational access could have ended there, if not for a very small private university in the most southern state called the University of Ujui, which is private and had a history of working with social movements. When the MSD proposed the idea to these professors, they were enthusiastic about supporting the movement. And so, in 1998, the first ever MSD-led Pedagogy of Land undergraduate degree program began through Pronera. 47 MSD activists from 15 states came to run the program. And the University of Ujui was so progressive, it became the perfect space for the MSD to experiment with their educational approach. First, they convinced the professors to organize a course through the Pedagogy of Alternation, where activists would go and study at the university intensely for 2 months, and then return to their communities to engage in local community research projects and their local activist jobs. The movement also supported student self-governance, collective work, collaborative living, the integration of disciplines, manual labor, and social struggle. So for example, to integrate the disciplines, every semester the movement would have one overarching theme, like gender and work, or agroecology. And then they would try to link all the courses they were taking to that one overarching theme. To implement collective work and student self-governance, they would split the cohort into small base groups called base nucleuses that were in charge of all the work, whether that was childcare or cooking or the more pedagogical aspects of class facilitation or choosing the curriculum. As Kozli Kardarchi, another national leader, told me, the base of the course was the university's curriculum, but all the extras, the spices, were from the movement. So it was a really impressive 4-year degree program. However, over the course of 4 years, a lot of tensions did develop between the ideals of the MST and the norms and practices of the university. For example, there were professors who just refused to change their teaching practice. There were disputes over who had the right to define the curriculum. There were conflicts between students. And there was even one student, he said he no longer wanted to do the collective work. And so the MST decided that he had to or he had to leave. And the professor supported his matriculation into a regular pedagogy degree program. And one activist told me about that incident, that it was then that we realized the university did not understand us or our proposal because they supported and valued the decision 100%. Nonetheless, the course kept going. And it wasn't until the last semester that a conflict emerged that could not be overcome. More specifically, by the end of the 1990s, early 2000s, the Ministry of Education was requiring that all higher and public education start issuing standardized exams for their students in order to have a national ranking system. The National Student Movement disagreed, and so they called for a boycott of these exams. However, the professors who had gone out on a limb to support the MST, this ranking was extremely important for this course to have national legitimacy. So the MST activists, they discussed it, they debated it, and they decided to respect the boycott. Putting salt on the wound, they didn't tell the professors. They simply went to take the test, and they left all of their exams blank, resulting in a failing grade for the national course. The professors were outraged. One of them told me that they did not allow anyone to know about their decision. There was no dialogue. Another professor said, "We agreed to work with the practices of the movement. We did what the movement wanted, but the movement refused to work with the practices of the university." The MST never again developed another Pronera course at the University of Ujui. Yeah. So some of you look a little shocked, right? But it actually isn't shocking, because according to the theory and the observations that I'm making, These conflicts could have been expected, right? This is an example of what I'm calling contentious co-governance. When social movements engage in the provision of public services with state actors, while simultaneously organizing contentious political actions and promoting practices that come into conflict with institutional norms and the interests of the state itself. And I would argue that these conflicts are going to happen even in a left-leaning government or a progressive institution, because the goals and norms of government, of a socialist movement, are always going to come into tension with institutions and governments in a capitalist, individualistic, and so-called meritocratic society, right? There's always going to be these conflicts. Luckily, they were over to the MSU was able to move forward, and despite these conflicts, the first Primera course actually created an institutional inroad where over the next decade, dozens and dozens of dozens of public universities all agreed to run Pronera undergraduate and graduate degree programs in partnership with the MSU. In addition, when Lula, the Workers' Party candidate, became president in 2003, funding for Pronera spiked, leading to tons and tons of more programs across the country. By 2011, in the higher educational realm, 3,323 students had graduated from 52 university programs. This is activists from the MSD having graduated from these programs. Again, this is surprising because Pronera was initially intended to be a literacy program, not an affirmative action program for the higher educational realm. However, the MSD used Pronera as a wedge to open doors into other institutions. Thus, the thing that we're always talking about in politics, institutionalization, was never a passive monolithic process, but rather an active struggle, one of ongoing contestation, setbacks, and advances. Over the past 10, 15 years, the type of Pronera programs have diversified, where you now have undergraduate programs in math, administration, even a bachelor's degree in law. And you also have graduate-level programs in family agriculture, education and Marxism, infant education. And really importantly, although these students who get a degree through Pronera have a regular university diploma after they finish, their educational experience is completely different. So for example, in the geography degree program, they have courses on geography of Brazil, economic geography, but they also learn about production alternatives for the Brazilian countryside, public policies and agrarian rights, environmental impacts and natural resources. And in the undergraduate law degree program, they learn about constitutional law, judiciary systems, but they also learn about the historical and social context of legal systems, agrarian law from a peasant perspective, and the legal structures of non-capitalist countries. In addition, every single Pronera program functions through this pedagogic alternation where students come together for 2 months and then return to their community to do local research projects, which allows for this articulation of theory and practice. So just two examples of this. In one infant education program, the cohort of students were asked during their community period to go back to their community and then interview the community about their social values and then create playgrounds that epitomize those social values. In another undergraduate program on pedagogy, one of the students' final research projects was to help the youth in the community collect empty tin cans and create musical instruments, and what became known as the Banjo de Laxa, the tin band, which he then theorized in his final research project. Every single student who goes through a Pronera program has to make this connection between theory and practice through research, by both investigating their local reality and then creating an intervention to transform that reality. I'm going to skip this, but in addition, the program has actually embodied something that's called triple governance, which is an explicit partnership between social movements, the university, and the federal government. And this educational program has undoubtedly built the MST and helped the movement thrive. Jean Pedro Sedley, who's a national leader of the MST, said, "The Pronera is one of the most valuable experiences we have. It is fighting against ignorance throughout the Brazilian countryside." Another leader said that these educational programs are pedagogical laboratories. They are privileged spaces because in no other space are activists together for an extended period of time, discussing and creating theories for the movement. And my favorite, Maria de Jesus, who was part of that first Pronera program at the University of Ujiwi, she said, "Now we have pedagogues, agronomists, lawyers, journalists, all the professions in the countryside that are important for the working class." Again, Pronera has transformed the MST from a movement of farmers with middle school education to a movement of farmers with college education, master's, and beyond. And it is precisely the ability of Pronera to support the internal organizing capacity of the MST that has led it open to external attacks, which brings us to our third and final struggle concerning Pronera, which is defending institutional gains. Are you all okay? So in 2005, the MST created an undergraduate degree program in agronomy through Pronera with the University of Mato Grosso. However, by 2008, there was a student in the program who was really angry about the collective work he had to do and the influence of the MST. And so he actually went to the Brazilian Congress's Federal Court of Audit, the TCU, and he complained about the course, saying that the MST had an undue influence. The Federal Court of Audit sent someone to investigate, and a few months later, they issued a scathing judgment of the course. They said that Pronera was being administered without a public call or open selective process, which allows professors to be chosen by an organization that is external to public oversight, the MST, which abuses the principles of impartiality and morality. They had a point, right? But they were really angry, and so they created a series of rules about the course, where they said that Pronera programs could no longer be through partnerships, it had to be an open bidding process, that you could not pay the university professors in the course, and that social movements could no longer participate. And so although they did not shut down Pronera, they basically paralyzed Pronera, and no courses could move forward. So what do you all think the MST did in response? Any guesses? They mobilized, right? So they did not just sit there passive, but they actively mobilized against these initiatives. And interesting, the movement that the MST was mobilizing now included hundreds of professors who previously had supported the movement, but through practice had become big supporters of Pronera as a means to offer educational activism to rural youth. And so the pinnacle of this mobilization happened in November 2010, when there were 600 both graduates and professors who had participated in Pronera programs, dozens of congressional reps, and 59 university provosts. That's not professors, that's provosts, who wrote a letter defending Pronera. The next day, President Lula shook the hand of MST activist Vanda Lucia Simplicio and actually created a presidential decree that turned Pronera into a public law and institutionalized the idea that social movements could participate. And so under this pressure for 2 years, the Federal Court of Audit had to respond. And so on December 1st, 2010, about a week after this handshake, the Federal Court issues a new judgment lifting all Pronera restrictions, which leads to more and more Pronera courses over the next decade. Okay, so in conclusion, Pronera really illustrates two of the major arguments in my book. One is that the story of Pronera shows that social movements' effective participation in formal institutions requires a combination of political advocacy and contentious protest. In my thesis, I highlighted three areas of struggle. First, to even get Pronera, the MST had to put 100,000 people in the streets. Then, to get higher educational access, they had to find a local ally. But even with this local ally, there were tons of tensions and conflicts. And then third, even under a left-leaning government, the MST had to constantly defend Pronera from outside attacks. And so again, institutionalization was never a reason of time in the MSU's education proposal, but rather a dynamic process that required both mobilization and political maneuvering to push forward institutional goals. And second, the case of Pranair shows that occupying formal institutions can help to build a movement's organizational and leadership capacity and resource base. In just a short decade, thousands of MSC leaders obtained higher education, including 15 students that graduated from a Pranair law degree program and are now lawyer activists in the movement. I would argue that Pranair defies the claim that Piven and Clower make that it is not possible to compel concessions from elites that can be used as resources to sustain oppositional organization over time. To the contrary, over the past two decades, Pranair has integrated more activists into the movement, has increased their political and technical expertise, and has allowed them to prefigure in the current world the type of socialist society that they want in the future. What's my time in here? So I want to end there. Except ethnography is a moving target, and politics in Brazil has gone radically right since I was doing this research. So if you all have a few, 5 more minutes, you can hold on, is that okay? I'm going to talk a little bit about how these arguments and how the MST itself is doing in this new right-wing context, okay? So just quickly, I'm sure most of you know this, but in 2016, the Workers' Party president, Dilma Rousseff, was kicked out of office in what most people refer to as an institutional coup. Her vice president and new political enemy, Michel Temer, immediately took office, reversing a lot of the Workers' Party's previous gains and policies. Then in October 2018, the global rise of right-wing populism hit Brazil hard with the election of this guy, Jair Bolsonaro, who was a former army captain and just weeks before had been a fringe candidate known primarily for his exuberant endorsement of war, torture, and assassination, for his violent misogyny, homophobia, and racism, his loathing of the poor, and his catastrophic environmental policies. And so for a country that had become known for its social experiments and social movement organizing, this was surprising, disheartening, and really downright scary. And so the rise of the right-wing resurgence in Brazil has really already affected the movement. You've had a general attack on workers and poor families through austerity policies, an increasing course of attempts to repress the movement. You have the passing of a policy that actually privatizes land settlements, gives people land titles so they no longer qualify for any public services. And as you can imagine, you have cuts in funding that support the MSU's economic and educational initiatives, including the end of Pranair. Now, despite these ongoing conservative attacks, I just want to end by saying why I still think there are reasons for cautious optimism about the MSU's future in this new political context. First, violence versus threat. Although Bolsonaro has promised that the welcome mat for a land invasion is going to be a bullet, he has actually not yet used the military or police to repress the movement. His hatred has emboldened other people, but that's very different than state-sanctioned violence. Instead, his strategy has been to starve the programs that previously supported the movement and to use legal tactics to attack the MSU's many agricultural and educational institutions. But the movement's fighting back, and legally in the courts, they're winning some of those battles. Second, there's the idea of untamed disruption. So with the PT out of power, the MST no longer has to do this political dance with the federal government. They can just protest. And for the first time ever, the entire left in Brazil is articulated within two big political fronts that are fighting against austerity reforms. Second, youth. Today, the MST Youth is a movement of young people. She's actually 16 right now. I just visited her last month. But it's a movement of young people who grew up in settlements and had an experience and experienced the MST's agricultural and educational alternatives. And fourth and finally, and this is my big point, is that the MST is now engaging in this contentious political struggle with a new arsenal of material, ideological, and socio-political resources which have been a result of what I've been talking about as the long march to the institutions. So in the agricultural realm, tens of thousands of people already have land access, dozens of agricultural cooperatives already exist. And although the federal government support was critical for those cooperatives to get off the ground, now they're part and parcel of the local economy. And so it would only be a really, really fascist, repressive government that could shut down those initiatives. And of course, it's the MSC's educational struggle that really shows why institutional gains can't be erased. Take Pernera over, but thousands and thousands of people have already gotten higher education degrees through the program. Furthermore, Pernera inspired another program during the PC government, which was a teaching certification in education in the countryside, which was based on Pernera, created in partnership with the MST, and then institutionalized in 40 universities with 10 tenure-track faculty in every university. Now that Pernera has ended, the MST is starting to work more with this other higher education program, and many MST actors are actually professors in these programs. And finally, the MSC's educational struggle, the majority of it, is not actually at the federal level. It's in the thousands of schools that are run by state and municipal governments. And although Bolsonaro won the election in 2018, he lost in almost all of the north and northeastern states. And that is where many governors and mayors that were still leftist actually got elected. And ironically, some of these sort of centrist leftists who never worked with the MST are now willing to work with the movement as a form of resistance against Bolsonaro. And even more importantly than these political opportunities are the activists in these schools. Every single person you see on the screen, and thousands more, have actually gone through Pernera programs to get higher education degrees. The only way that poor rural youth can get educational access. And so these young people know exactly what they're fighting for in these schools because they lived it for 4 years. So I would argue that these schools, these Pernera programs, represented what Erica Lynn Wright called real utopias, which allowed MSC educational activists to envision the contours of an alternative social world that embodies emancipatory ideals. Thus, these local activists now have a clear educational vision and a degree to legitimize it. And I'm just going to end with one ethnographic vignette. One final story. So, in September 2015, at a gathering of 1,200 teachers in Brasilia, MSC national leader Jean Pedro Sedley exhorted the crowd. The working class needs to organize its class project, and in order to do this, we have to organize in all spaces of social life. He said, some people don't understand power. They think we can just take the presidential palace and then have power. But there's nowhere in Brazil with less power than the presidential palace. The crowd laughed at this remark, all too appropriate as thousands of people across the country were calling for President Rousseff's impeachment. Then João Pedro pointed to a picture of Gramsci in the back of the auditorium. We prefer to follow Gramsci, who says that people have to create their own social project and contest power in all spaces of social life, the school, the land, the Senate, and the presidential palace. We are here this week to discuss how to continue one single chapter of our struggle, the conquest of knowledge and education. So in conclusion, the long march to institutions has never been about electing political officials. It's a much deeper form of engaging the state that's about envisioning your social and political project in all state spheres. And it's predicated on the fact that the electoral sphere is unstable, and when some opportunities open, others will shut down. And so the MSC itself arose under a period of dictatorship and got the majority of its gains during a right-wing federal government. When Lula was elected, he opened up federal opportunities, but he did not fundamentally change the MSC's strategy of finding different access points in the state to push forward their social goals. So now the test. We're going to see the pros, strains, and cons of the long march of institutions now with a neo-fascist right-wing government. And so all eyes should be on Brazil because the future of state-society relations in Brazil will certainly affect the rest of America. Thank you for having me.
Leo, take it away.
Well, let me first of all
congratulate the Global Labor Research Center. It's marvelous to see so many people here. To hear Rebecca talking about this really important book. I've now been retired for 3 years, and to come back and see the role that the Global Labor Research Center is playing, which is so badly needed at York, I'm really happy to see this. It really is marvelous. Congratulations. Rebecca's book, as I said, is really important. And it's really important because, obviously, for what it tells us about the MST in Brazil, but it's important because it captures what I think is the zeitgeist on the left. For a considerable period of time, understandably, with the rise of neoliberal globalization, and with the collaboration of social democratic parties in that, and with the demise of the communist regimes, very understandably, there was an anarchist resurgence, ideologically and strategically, on the left. It was very much present in the anti-globalization movement, where there was a disdain, as it was put very famously in a book I'm sure many of you have read, Changing the World Without Taking Power. And the heroes of that book were the Zapatistas, right? In Mexico. What has happened really since Occupy, which still reflected that disdain for going into the state, was a realization on the part of a great deal of the people who were engaged in protest that you can protest until hell freezes over and you won't change the world. And with Occupy, there was a very short bridge from that and from the indignados in the squares of Europe to Podemos, to Syriza, to the Corbyn and the Sanders insurgencies inside the Democratic Party of the United States and, of all places, the Labor Party inside in the United Kingdom. A realization that one needs to be, as was put at the time of the first insurgency inside the Labor Party in the 1970s, one needs to be in and against the state. And Rebecca's book captures this. If you like, it's the MST versus the Zapatistas. But the MST comes out of, as she shows so well, because the history in this book is remarkable, comes out of a general orientation which I think reflected the struggle against the military regime by the end of the 70s, which was common to those activists, those organizers who created the MST, the People's Movement, but simultaneously created the Workers' Party in Brazil, and simultaneously created what looked like, for a period, was going to be the most radical labor movement in the world, the CUT, the CUT. And they all took the position that we are organizers. That's what we're good at. We're organizers. We're cadre, we're organizers. We need to get into the state. But once we get into the state, we have to continue to be organized. And we have to use state resources to organize those who've been unorganized. Unger has made a career out of teaching this at Harvard. But he learned it from his early days in Brazil. The notion of participatory budgeting, which so captured the attention of so many people at the turn of the millennium, with Porto Alegre taken as its model for all the people who went to world social forums from around the world in Porto Alegre, Brazil, in the years after 2000, was actually a disappointment in this respect. Yes, it involved giving state resources. The PT had been elected in Porto Alegre, been elected the mayor by the end of the 80s. And in establishing the tertiary budget program, it's true, they were giving resources to uneducated black women who were elected out of their favelas onto the PB boards to make decisions with those resources about whether they would pave a road, whether they would install a sewer, etc. And people came to Porto Alegre, much like Sidney and Beatrice Webb went to the Soviet Union in 1935 and said, I've seen the future and it works. And at the very time that the show trials were just about to begin, people came there very naive. And so Judith is smiling because she probably remembers we were both there at the same time. And heard representatives of the PT government telling them how flawlessly this worked. But in fact, the history budget process was full of contradictions and limitations. Not least the important strategic questions that the city and state government had to deal with were never put to those activist women. Yes, they were allowed to whether they were going to spend this or that on a sewer or a road. But the strategic questions of how they were to deal with the landlords who were reclaiming the land once they built those roads and sewers so that the land could be productive again, this was never put to the participants of the tertiary budget. In other words, their strategic capacity was not developed. The MST, and I've been there often, I've been to the national school, I got to know Stabile very well, was always remarkably different than this, and I thought it was because the MST had its own space. The landless people moved and occupied land, created camps, eventually created permanent settlements under those camps. It had its own space. And one could see that it was directly engaged in developing the political and strategic educating, in the best political sense, its own members. And I assumed it was because they were doing it in their own space. What I learned from reading Rebecca's book, and I learned enormously from it, was that, yes, they were doing that. But they were simultaneously doing it, and indeed they were able to do it, precisely by being engaged in transforming educational apparatuses that the state provided to them. Not only by winning state schools, public education, on the settlements, but also by developing MST members' capacities, not only inside the movement struggles, not only at their own national school, just south of Sao Paulo, but also by developing their capacities inside the state system. And she captures very well how this was done in great detail. Quite brilliantly, and she mentioned, but I'm not sure people quite caught it, one of the great contradictions of this. That one of the encampments in Rio Grande do Sul, where Porto Alegre is located, was not being supported, and they went to Porto Alegre and occupied. They ran the encampment school, which was being paid for by the state, while they were doing that education on the lawn of the assembly. And you can see the way in which resources were being used. Now, on the other hand, what the PT had found, and it is much more problematic for a party, as soon as they started getting elected as mayors in the late 1980s, was that if they hired a bus with state funds, to take a group of people from Rio Grande do Sul to Brasilia to protest the way in which federal state services were being offloaded onto the states and the cities, because that's the main way neoliberalism works. It offloaded central expenditures, including in Canada, onto local governments. But if they tried to hire a bus to take protesters to Brasilia, they were immediately accused of clientelism. And since their whole struggle had been to do away with the clientelist capitalist state, they didn't know how to answer this. So they stopped doing it. The MST didn't have that contradiction. And really, to read this is just phenomenal in this respect. What's also phenomenal, and I don't think anyone has done this in this kind of literature, is that Rebecca has identified the way in which this can be done inside clientelist state apparatus. Not only with sympathetic governments in place, but precisely insofar as clientelist governments have weak state apparatus, they can become dependent upon, and did become dependent upon, the MST in order to engage in social reproduction, which is what the school system does for them. And in that process, the MST was able to educate and radicalize many of the teachers who were suspicious of the MST originally. Very, very important. Okay. What does this tell us, then, about social movement theory, or indeed socialist theory? One of the great defects of most of the theorizing about social movements that has become so prevalent in academia over the last 30, 40 years, in direct contrast with the literature, the traditional study of political parties, is that it is almost universally uninterested in the internal organization of movements. It's all been about the mobilization, right, the ideology, but very few studies have actually examined the internal organization of social movements. And as a result, as you know, the word social movement is often applied to find people with a radical agenda. The MST, of course, is the direct contrast, that it actually has a permanent organization, a structure, capacity that doesn't simply rely on the talent of the leadership, the radicalism of leadership, which then, when it needs to earn a living, those three or four or five people disappear because they get families, they get jobs, etc. And what happened to the movement is gone. To have this studied so well is very, very important. Moreover, what is this? There are social movements and social movements. And what is distinctive about the MST as a social movement is that it is a class movement and it is an explicitly socialist movement. The Long March for the institutions makes no sense unless you understand that the Long March means the Long March to socialism. Right. Not an insurrectionary strategy, right, but the long march through the institutions to transcend capitalism and transform the capitalist state rather than smashing in the old insurrectionary sense of that term. Most of the literature on social movements arose in hostility to class analysis and to the grand narrative of replacing capitalism with socialism. So in a sense, what Rebecca is doing is taking the social movement literature back to class analysis and back to socialist strategy. And that's enormously important. And finally, it does more than that. This is a very sober and balanced book. It is not cheerleading. I've just written a critique of Eric Olin Wright's Real Utopias project and his book, Envisaging Real Utopias. Not for his image that we need to prefigure transformation, not for his understanding that one needs to engage in what Rebecca calls contentious co-government. That's all about what real utopias is about. But rather because he simply was uninterested in doing the hard, empirical, ethnographic work to look at the contradictions soberly of the actual movements and strategies that he is praising in this respect. In the Canadian case, he pumps up enormously the economic partnerships in Quebec that developed in the 1990s in the most naive way. And it was the rejection of that by activists which led to the founding of the Quebec Solidaire Party. Similarly, he uses participatory budgeting 10 years after it was already analyzed with all of its contradictions by Brazilians in a way that is cheerleading for people outside of Brazil. Okay. I want to pose a couple of questions to Rebecca and then I'll be quiet. To a certain extent, it seems to me, Rebecca, that you say that the MSG transformed Brazilian education. I wonder, though, whether it wasn't using those portions of the educational apparatus in order to meet the needs of its own space, rather than actually transforming the whole of the Brazilian educational apparatus. It was about building the capacities of people to operate inside the settlements, to operate inside the movements, rather than to transform the educational apparatus. I don't know if that's right, but that strikes me as having been the case. In that sense, it's not quite the same as changing the state. And secondly, what is the difference between trying to change a state apparatus that's involved in social reproduction and a state apparatus like a central bank or a treasury, a finance ministry, a ministry of trade that's engaged in economic reproduction? And don't we need to try to think through how much more difficult it is to do it in the latter case than in the former? And then finally, what is the difference between paying such attention to developing the strategic capacities of one's activists and membership and so on, in the case of a social movement like the MST, and doing that in a political party? Your criticism of Michel's is right in a way, but he is speaking of a mass political party that's aimed at taking state power and transforming it. And what is the difference then between that and you point out, and I didn't know this, that in some ways the MST was inspired by Leninism, by democratic centralism, is not enormously democratic in its internal structures. So I'd like to hear you talk about those.
Okay, we have 14 minutes left, which
oh,
means
sorry,
so no. Thank you. Rebecca, did you want to take one more question to add to that, or do you feel like you'll need the full 12?
I think it's good for people to say.
Yeah.
So why don't we do a round of questions, and then I'll answer those questions
sure.
And respond to
yeah.
Questions.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe we'll do a couple of questions. Yeah. Go ahead. Hi.